It's really a pleasure for me to be here today. I've been invited to share with you this morning a little bit about what I do as chaplain at Children's Hospital. Let me tell you a little bit about Children's Hospital in Richmond. It's a small specialty hospital. It's not an acute care. Every child that comes there for care, whether it's inpatient or outpatient, is referred. So a child doesn't come directly there for care from the home. They're actually referred there. We have, right now, 25 inpatient beds, and by September that will be up to 45. And all of those inpatient beds are long-term care for children. So essentially, it's think nursing home for children. And all of these children are very medically fragile, requiring very high tech care needs. Most of them are extremely compromised cognitively and mentally and physically. All but one are fed through a feeding tube, and a number of them have trachs, are requiring some type of oxygen on a daily basis. Many of them have cerebral palsy to varying degrees of severity, seizures. And most of them are cognitively, even though they range in age from, about 3 years old to 20 years old, cognitively, with the exception of one, they range in age from probably 1 to 3 years old, perhaps. I'm not telling you that to depress you. I'm telling you that to define, to kind of describe this group of kids. And they're wonderful to be amongst, and their families. We also, at Children's Hospital, do a lot of outpatient rehab and a lot of specialty clinics. One in particular that's a well-known, it's kind of a nationally cutting-edge program, is called the Feeding Program. And it's for children, again, could be less than a year old all the way through the early teen years, but the average age is toddlers. And the kids come here either on two or three times a week or else every day for during the week, to learn how to eat, to take food by mouth, and gradually work up to where they get all their calories from the food they take by mouth as opposed to the feeding tube. Let me read you what my major responsibilities are, and this comes right off the hospital chaplain position description. So this should give you an idea of what I do. Provides pastoral care to patients, their families, and staff. Develops and maintains relationships with and or resources for faith groups, service area clergy, and churches. Develops materials and procedures to guide the clinical staff on how to access pastoral care. Acts as a resource to various disciplines within the hospital. Integrates spiritual counseling with other collaborating psychosocial team members. Works with teams to resolve health issues that may require special handling due to a patient's religious beliefs. Provides educational and awareness programs to increase clinical sensitivity to the spiritual needs of patients and families, particularly in the light of multicultural diversity. Assists families and staff with end-of-life circumstances and the grieving process, and serves on the Hospital Ethics Committee. Now, you just heard my position description, and that's what I get evaluated on every year. So those are pretty tangible, pretty measurable. But what I really want to talk about today is more from a philosophical or spiritual standpoint about what I believe my role is as chaplain at Children's Hospital. And that is, it all boils down to helping people discover transforming moments that make a genuine difference in their lives. And that's my goal on a day-to-day basis. And I try to do this through three major ways. One is to nurture relationships among staff, patients, and their families. A second way is to accompany the suffering. And a third way is to help people who are in crisis to change the questions that they're asking. And I'll spend a little time on each one of these three ways. In terms of nurturing relationships, from a purely practical standpoint, good working relationships are literally a matter of life and death in a hospital. It is critical that medical staff be comfortable in working with each other as they care for the children whose medical needs must be met. Beyond this obvious example, I believe that it is essential to have solid, trusting relationships among staff, patients and families in order to handle crises when they do occur. When there is a foundation of trust and solidarity among all parties, then the fear and chaos that a crisis often brings can be reduced, and recovery from an emotional and spiritual and physical standpoint is more likely, and it's more likely to happen sooner. Familiarity and trust builds the teamwork necessary for effective and efficient health care. And furthermore, trusted relationships from a spiritual standpoint are the fertile ground from which transformative experiences grow. Indeed, the building of such relationships is transforming. Whenever we interact with someone, there is at least potential for one or the other, or hopefully both people, to be transformed in some way just by experiencing another person. And the more interactions, the greater potential for each to be changed in a positive and growing way. I see my role as chaplain in this regard as that of initiating new relationships that are mutually beneficial and also nurturing relationships that already exist. And much of this type of pastoral care, this type of chaplaincy that I do, boils down to hospitality, and that's what I call it, the ministry of hospitality. Some examples include for the inpatient unit, we have what our hospital-wide part of our mission statement is family-centered care. We know better than to think that we are providing treatment just for the child. The child is part of the family system, and we want to care for and support the whole family. And so we offer a lot of activities where the whole families can come visit their child who lives in our building, and to be able to have some, engage in some activities, share a meal together, get some education about what the inpatient unit is all about, and how they can do more things for their children, planning and that type of thing. So we do family support dinners, and we do family days on Saturdays, about one Saturday every other month, where they come in for lunch, and we have activities and arts and crafts and things for the siblings to do. So we do a lot of family-centered activities. I also have one of my favorite things that I do is called the Comfort Hour for the feeding program. The feeding program is a program for children that are aged, usually around toddler age. I think I described that already. And these kids come here on an inpatient basis. The more intense is they're there for 8 weeks. They don't live at the hospital, but they have to stay in the Richmond area. And we get a lot of families outside the Richmond area, and probably a third of the families that come to our program are coming from even from another state. So they are taking 8 weeks out of their lives and moving to Richmond and staying in a hotel while their child comes, and they accompany their child to the feeding program where they get three or four feedings a day, Monday through Friday, so that they can learn how to take food in by mouth. As you can imagine, this is very disruptive for families. Oftentimes, the other parent and remaining siblings are left back in Arizona or back in Colorado, and grandparents move in to help. And so it's pretty disruptive, and it's very stressful when you think about a mother not being able to provide food to feed their child. That's as basic as you can get in terms of caring for a child. So it's very stressful. And this Comfort Hour is a noon hour. They get to bring their lunch down. There's child care provided for their children while they're taking naps between their feedings. And they get to come down, and it's a Calgon take me away moment, hour, where they actually get to forget about what they're dealing with every other hour of that day and that week and those 8 weeks. And they bring their lunches down, and I have a massage therapist or a manicurist, or we do arts and crafts, or we make nachos, or we bake cookies, or we have pizza, or we watch comedy. So for that hour, they get to just leave that part that's just working on them in their lives for all that time, for an hour, and come away. And that's a way of building relationships between them and me, between them and the greater public. These massage therapists and manicurists and volunteers come from the outside, who come and volunteer their time to be with these families, transforming for all of us. Accompanying the suffering. Out of the three roles, admittedly, this is the most difficult for me, and I think if you were to ask any chaplain, that they would agree that that's the most difficult part of the chaplaincy role, and that is accompanying the suffering. Fulfilling this role requires me to resist my greatest temptation as a chaplain, or just as a person, and that is to fix the situation. And a lot of times there are things that can be done and are being done, but there are some times that not much more can be done to fix it. And so the only thing that I can do, and I say only because it is a big thing, but it feels like it's only, and that is to be with them and to assure them that they're not alone. It requires empathy, which is truly imagining myself in the grieving person's position. And it actually means more than just imagining that. It really means trying to embody that. And what I have learned is, in order to most genuinely do that, is I have to pretend like I have no spiritual and emotional and psychological, let alone physical, resources. I have to imagine that I am at the end of my rope and have nowhere else to turn and no one else to lean on. Then I'll have a sense of where some of these families might be. And it means that I constantly have to ask myself, and I do this just to keep myself aware, repeatedly, questions like, what if I didn't have the luxury of walking out of this room in 10 minutes and going on to my next thing? And what if I didn't have the luxury of clocking out at the end of the day and I can leave this behind and go home where no one is sick and no one's needing my care? And I'm not worried about where my next meal's coming from or the next insurance bill or anything like that. What if I didn't have that luxury? What would I feel like then? And how desperate and despondent would I be? Now, that takes a lot of kind of peeling back layers. And basically, that's what it means, is I have to be as willing to be as vulnerable to pain as this person is in right now. Sometimes that's difficult, but there, again, it's a transformative experience. Here's another excerpt from Kat Duff's book. You heard a reading from her book. Here's another one. There is, perhaps rightly so, an invisible rope that separates the sick from the well, so that each is repelled by the other, like magnets reversed. The well venture forth to accomplish great deeds in the world, while the sick turn back onto themselves and commune with the dead. Neither can face the other very comfortably without intrusions of envy, resentment, fear, or horror. Frankly, from the viewpoint of illness, healthy people seem ridiculous, even a touch dangerous. In the blinded busyness, marching like soldiers to the drumbeat of duty and desire. Their world, to which we once belonged and will again most likely, seems unreal, like some kind of board game that could fold up at any minute. Carl Jung reported that when he was recovering from a heart attack, the view from his window seemed like a painted curtain with black holes in it, or a tattered sheet of newspaper full of photographs that meant nothing. He despaired of getting well and having to, quote, convince myself all over again that this was important, unquote. Suffering is a transforming experience. In the crucible of suffering, one learns what is most true and what is most everlasting. And anything that doesn't withstand that test is lost. That which is lost is mourned, but that which survives the punishing heat is taken to heart and cherished. No family that has ever entered children's hospital to receive care for their sick child returns home unchanged. And to whatever degree I am able to truly and genuinely enter that crucible with the family, then I too am transformed. I've been at Children's Hospital a little over 3 years, and I call the first 3 years the honeymoon period. That was a pretty long honeymoon, actually. And the reason I called it that was, and I didn't start calling that until it was after the 3 years, and events happened, but on the inpatient unit where these medically fragile children live, every single one of us knows that on any day, any of these children could die. Mostly they're all stable, but that could change in a moment. And we all know this here. And when some of us know it better here. And for 3 years, we had no deaths on the unit. The only deaths that were happening were to family members of staff. Which there's a great need for pastoral care there, but I was like, I could get used to this. And then we had two deaths within 29 days of each other. One was anticipated, one not quite so anticipated. But it did kind of put that back on the radar screen to say, this is why we're here, and this is what happens. And it doesn't just happen to these sick children, it happens everywhere. But it also it transformed me in terms of being with the suffering and being with the families who've lost their children. But it also enhanced my relationship with the staff that I work with there and with the families. So I'm a different chaplain coming out of that, out of December and January, than I was heading in to those. Definitely transforming experiences. Changing the questions, that's the last area. And here's a final excerpt from Duff. It seems to be endemic to the experience of illness to confront body and soul and wonder why it has happened. I suspect that the consideration of guilt and responsibility is part of the process of cleansing and correcting that illness facilitates. Whatever comes up in the asking, whether it is the memory of leaving one's mother to die alone, as it was for Mae Sarton after her stroke, or the realization that Agent Orange kills, as it was for many Vietnam veterans who developed cancer, that is where the meaning lies. That is what we must address and redress in some way with an apology, self-forgiveness, or political action, whatever is called for. Whether we come to realize our illnesses are accidents of birth, the result of radiation exposure, God's punishment, God's grace, whatever, there is always a teaching to be found. That does not necessarily mean that teaching is the purpose of illness, nor does it mean that sick people are more in need of that advice. It is just an inevitable outcome of the profound transformation that comes with the territory. In the terrible clarity of the nearness of death, what hobby turned ignorance, as it exists in ourselves and our world, is stripped away, if only for a moment. Our lives condense, collapse, and recoalesce, requiring changes, and we are responsible to those changes. We are not responsible for our illnesses. We are responsible to them, to what they offer and require of all of us, sick and well alike. For the families of the children we serve at Children's Hospital, life has been dramatically changed by their children's medical conditions. Some of these children were born with the conditions for which they're being treated. Some have developed them over time, and some suffered very sudden incidents that instantly changed their lives from quote-unquote normal to chaos. Regardless of how or when the events happened that changed these families forever, some of the same questions arise. Why did this happen? What did I do to deserve this? How will I ever get through this? When will things be normal again? When will the pain go away? And how do I give my child the best life he or she can have? For some of these questions, there is no right answer, and for others, the answer is as complex as the situation that prompted it. Because I feel it's my job to provide a comforting but truthful answer, I often try to pose to the family when they are ready a different way of stating the question. One that either provides comfort or helps them move forward in the grieving process. So here's some examples of those changed questions. From why did this happen to what is the meaning of this? In many families, every family has that question to ask. One in particular, a family I remember, we used to have an inpatient rehab unit. Now those beds have all transitioned over to long-term care. But this was a father of a 17-year-old. His daughter was in a car accident, and she suffered a very severe brain injury. And when I asked him in one of my visits, where are you grounding your faith? What are you standing on right now? In what or who do you place your faith at this time? And he said, I don't know. So he couldn't answer that question. But he said, but I do know what's not happening here. I do know what isn't the meaning of this. I know that this is not punishment. I know that this isn't because I was a good or bad father. I know this isn't because she was a good or bad daughter. I know this isn't for anything she or I have ever done or haven't done. So that part I know. So he wasn't able to say what was the meaning of it. That's a day-to-day exploration and a day-to-day journey. But at least on that day that I talked with him, he was able to say, I know it's not that. From what did I do to deserve this, or another way to say it is, what did I do wrong, to what shall I do with this? One of the children actually is a young man now. He just turned 19 last week. Was an unfortunate victim of an accidental gunshot through the throat, and he's a quadriplegic. He is fully functioning from the throat up, but nothing from the throat down. As you can imagine, he was very, very angry about what happened to him and about the outlook for the rest of his life. He took a lot of that anger out on his mother, who wasn't in the room when he and his buddies were just passing around a gun and looking at it, but she was his mother, and that counts for something when you're a teenager. So there was a lot of anger there, and he was quite angry with her. And she wore that anger for a long time, and she pretty much went into a recluse and had to go through her own dark night of the soul and her own journey with that, with her son's anger, and emerged out of that about a year later saying, I know this is not my, that's not my stuff to carry. I've got stuff to carry, but that's not mine. And so I'm relieved, and I can come back, and I'll visit my son every day, and I know he still doesn't want me in the room, but I'll still show up every day and tell him I love him and kiss him on the head. And he has his journey, and I have mine. And that's what she did with that. She wouldn't have been able to make that journey if she couldn't have made that shift in questioning. From how will I ever get through this to what shall I do right now, this moment? I was only chaplain there for, I think I was in my second week, and a staff member had just come back from maternity leave, and it was her third day back from maternity leave, and she received a call at her workstation from the paramedics who were on the way to the hospital with her infant who had stopped breathing, and the child did not survive, and we didn't know that till we got to the hospital, but there we were, sitting in front of the gurney with her deceased child. And as you can imagine, she was just a wreck. And she sobbed and begged and just said, what am I going to do without her? I'll just die. I just can't even imagine living without her. And I said, you will get through this, but you have to not think about your whole life without her. You can't do that. That's way too big. You have to think about what you need to do right this minute. And right this minute, you're doing the right thing. You are honoring your child. You are loving her. You're missing her, and you are mourning her loss. And you're calling her by name, and you're telling her you love her. You're doing exactly what you need to be doing right now. And that's what she did, that moment and the next moment and the next moment. And each moment calls for something different, that moment. That's how you get through it. What shall I do with this? What shall I do with this right now? The good news is she had another child after that, not a replacement, but she does have two children that she adores. From when will the pain go away to what do I do with this pain? My favorite line of this that I borrowed from a counselor years ago was, put your pain to work. And the numerous examples of this, but one of my favorite ones is a family who did come from Arizona and stayed in Richmond for 8 weeks while their triplets went through the feeding program. And they went back to Arizona so impressed with this program and so happy with the results that they got the ball rolling to start the development of a similar feeding program in their town. From how do I give my child the best life he or she can have? Another way to say that is, how can I bless my child? To how does my child give me the best life I can have? How does my child bless me? And over these 3 years, I have learned, again, I knew it cognitively, but I'm learning it more and more in my tissues and bones and cells day by day, that each child there blesses their parents and their staff, and that includes me. They bless us by enjoying the highest quality of life that they can. And they do have a high quality of life at Children's Hospital. They go to school, they get music, they get art, they go to the movies, they go to the mall, they even go to the beach. They have a very high quality of life that they probably would not be able to have if they were still living in the home, in their own homes. They bless us by demonstrating to us their diversity in abilities and adaptations, miraculous as they are, and I see little miracles every day. They bless us by teaching us to accept disability and death. In all of the examples of these questions, the first question tends to trap people in a stalled grieving process, and it tends to focus more on the past, why did this happen, or the future, when will we be over it? Neither of which they can do anything about, whereas the second or the redirected question is much more present-based, and it also invites transformation. I have the best job in the world because I get to nurture relationships among people, which of course results in me being nurtured in return. This community-building aspect of my job is immensely rewarding and fulfilling. I have the best job because I get to accompany the suffering. Yes, you heard that right. This means that neither they nor I am ever alone in our grief. And we recognize our common humanity and our common fate. I have the best job in the world because I get to faithfully pose different questions in the face of loss and have those questions seriously entertained by those who ache but long not to. I have the best job in the world because I get to be reminded that while loss and grief are everywhere, not just in the hospital where I work, so are opportunities to be transformed. So are opportunities to reconcile with disability and death, to make memories, to challenge expectations of quote-unquote normal, that's a setting on your dryer, that's all, and to carry on in faith, love, and good and abundant company. I have the best job in the world because I get to be the monk who brings the fruit to the worried burrow. I get to look in sad eyes with hope. I get to touch a hand and momentarily love that person free of their pain. I have the best job in the world, and I thank you for this opportunity for letting me share it with you.